From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. You've probably heard of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and various estimates of how huge this mass of plastic really is. But what about microplastics? These are the tiny pieces that never break down. Instead, they show up in our soil, water, food, and as UNH researchers are learning, on our beaches. This hour on The Exchange, microplastics, and later we continue our Race for the First series, meeting the many candidates for the first congressional district. Today, we sit down with Democrat Daeglin McEachran. Let's hear from you. First, your questions on microplastics. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Gabriella Bratt. She's fisheries specialist with UNH Cooperative Extension and the New Hampshire Sea Grant. And Gabby, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Jennifer Kennedy, executive director at the Blue Ocean Society, survey director for the Marine Debris Monitoring Program at Jenice Beach. And Jennifer, good to meet you. Thank you also for being
here. Thanks for having me.
So we've all heard, you know, for the past decade, maybe even two, about plastics in our oceans. People may have seen photos of those giant Pacific plastic blobs. I just learned this morning there isn't just one, there's several. How do microplastics, Jen, fit into that larger, uglier narrative?
Well, it's all marine debris or plastic pollution, and microplastics, they can be either start out as tiny pieces of plastic. They're just plastic pieces or plastic pre-production pellets, which maybe we'll talk about a little bit later. Or they are parts of those bigger pieces of trash that get lost out in the ocean or on our beaches or somewhere in the environment and then break down into smaller pieces. So sometimes they start out small. Sometimes it's just things that are left on the beach that wash out in the ocean, get washed around and just start breaking up.
So the word micro implies very small. So Gabby, how small are they?
So there's the NOAA definition of microplastics is anything 5 millimeters and under. And then after 1 millimeter in size, it becomes a nanoplastic. So that's sort of the standard size that we've all been going by for the last, you know, decade or so. And so they do. They get smaller and smaller and smaller. And I think I read a statistic that said that every piece of plastic ever made since the 1950s when single-use plastics and plastics in general exploded is still around in some form of, or another.
Wow.
And so it just keeps, they just keep breaking down and breaking down and leaching out and so on.
So NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they study this, they take pictures, they measure and so forth. So I'm not very good with sizes. So 5 millimeters or smaller is what, like a grain of rice or the head of a pin or what is it?
5 millimeters is about the size of one of those little plastic beads that you put on, you know, little kid bracelets. You see those a lot. And then smaller than that to about the head of a pin and a, you know, grain of rice.
So that's pretty tiny. So what's the problem, Jen? It sounds innocuous.
They're small, but they can cause a problem. And we're not, I guess the first thing to say is that we're not really sure what all the problems are yet. There is still a lot of research to be done. But one of the problems, as far as we're concerned, we do a lot of work with marine life and marine mammals. And they're, since microplastics are so small, they're pretty much accessible to the entire food chain. So they can be swallowed by the tiny plankton. And it, we don't, again, we don't really understand right now if those tiny plankton that eat the plastics, if the plastics are affecting them or they're just kind of passing them through, but and then all the way up to large whales. And so it really can affect lots of different things. And as you said in the introduction, we're not really sure kind of how it relates to us and our food. And you know, anything that's made of synthetic materials, like even, you know, if you're wearing polyester clothing or you're sitting on chairs made of polyester or whatever, that can be shedding little pieces of fiber. So they're basically everywhere. And so we don't really understand a lot about, you know, we know they're everywhere, but we don't really understand the risk quite yet.
When did people start focusing on these, Gabby, these microplastics?
So what's interesting is when I first started looking at this several years ago with Jen, I started doing some research, and it was showing up in the Piscataqua River Estuary Report back in the 70s. And that, with along with marine debris, people are sort of figuring this out that, oh, wait, we're now becoming a society super dependent on plastics and plastic products, and they don't actually go anywhere. And now we're starting to see it in our waterways and in our water bodies and so on. So it's not just a marine debris issue. It's in freshwater systems as well, in streams, rivers, lakes. They're really prevalent in the Great Lakes. And so it's been in the literature off and on since the 70s. It really exploded in the last 8 years or so. Jen and I started our project in 2014, and it was just sort of getting some notoriety. But now, every day almost, it seems, there's a story about microplastics or plastics, plastic pollution in the papers and the news and things like that.
What's that explosion of interest, research, study about?
I think it's people are becoming more and more aware of, at least my perspective, about where their food is coming from. So especially in the fishing industry and the seafood industry, people are now starting to pay attention to the fact that, oh, there's this, you know, floating pieces of garbage around here. Maybe somehow or other it might be getting into what I am ingesting. And as soon as you relate something to you, I think the interest explodes. So it's not that far removed from the possibility that you could be eating something that you didn't think you were eating before. And I think the more you get into this and the more you discover it, it's like Pandora's box. There's more and more and more. Because initially, we didn't even consider fibers. And now, you know, all of a sudden you're like, oh, I can't even buy fleece anymore because I wash it and it's in my muscles or so on.
Yeah, and we'll definitely make that connection for folks in a minute because I was doing some reading on that and there's a lot to talk about there. But what do you think, Jen? What's behind this rising interest, research, concern about microplastics?
I think, you know, it's just marine debris in general has become, and plastic pollution in general has become a lot bigger of an issue and research concern and concern in the public over the last, you know, 10 or 15 years. Nobody was, as Gabby said, you know, we started doing cleanups in 2001. And at that point, everybody was focused on the macro debris, like going out to the beach and removing big things like, you know, dumping on the beach tires and, you know, bottles and cans and things like that. And I think we got interested in the issue because we had been doing cleanups for a long time. And I noticed that, you know, when I was following behind a group of cleanup volunteers, they were picking up the big things, but then there were all these little things, like at Genesee Beach in particular, which we've been cleaning for the last 17 years. Every month, there tends to be a ton of those little tiny white styrofoam balls, and we're not really sure where they're coming from, if they're coming from maybe like dock floats or something like that, but they are all over the beach. But the volunteers, I think, tend to miss them because they just kind of blend in with the seaweed, and they're focusing on the bigger things. And I think more and more people were noticing that. And, you know, it's possible that as we got more plastic into the environment, you know, more and more was breaking up, which means over time you're just going to keep getting more microplastics unless you clean up the big plastics first before, you know, you can pick up one plastic bottle or you can pick up a million pieces that came from that plastic bottle after it breaks up over time.
Go ahead, Gabby.
I also think in this day and age of social media and instantaneous, you know, you take a picture and you upload it. And if you have a, you know, big following, people are going to start becoming more and more aware. I think that has driven a lot of interest as well.
Well, and with microplastics, though, it's easy to take a picture of myself or video me and my friends out doing a beach cleanup. And we pick up all these big soda bottles and leftover, you know, child sand toys and so forth. And it looks great. But microplastics, you can't really see them right away, right, Gabby?
I mean, right. No, you can't. And to go back to when, you know, Jen and I first started thinking about how to approach this, I had little babies and we were at the beach and they would dump their goldfish or whatever. I mean, they were babies. They would grab a handful and all around them, for me, it was the cigarette butts. And that's when I was like, uh-oh, there's something else in here. And I would, you know, I would shake out their hand and there would be really close to a cigarette butt or a piece of fragment or the styrofoam balls. And as a mom, that freaked me out because I was like, what is this and how much of it have you already eaten? No, you can't see them at first. But it's funny because once you sort of get used to it, you start looking and that's all you see.
Go ahead, Jen.
I was just going to say that we also, since we had been doing beaches, cleaning beaches for so long, we had an Adopt-A-Beach program that we started in 2004 that involves people in cleaning beaches. And they, after they were cleaning their beach, you know, every month, and we were cleaning Genesee Beach once a month, we had gotten kind of all the big stuff. And, you know, that kind of monthly maintenance, there wasn't as much stuff to find, it seemed. And so we had to start looking harder because we were going to the beach every month anyway. And then it was like, wait, you know, we really got to focus on not just picking up 100 pounds, but maybe it's 1,000 pieces instead, and picking up every little thing, kind of doing a, we always tell our volunteers, do quality over quantity. You want to get that stretch of beach as clean as possible, which requires picking up the little things too. Now that we've kind of picked up all the big things and there's not a lot of dumped, you know, areas where there's dumped trash anymore, just because we're kind of maintaining it over time.
Although picking up the big things is good too, yes. Right? If you pick up the giant soda bottle, then that won't turn into microplastics.
Right. Yeah.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We're learning about microplastics this hour in the Exchange. Many researchers say cleaning up these tiny particles from our oceans is the next huge challenge, but vitally important. We're talking with researchers here in New Hampshire who examine microplastics and clean them up on our beaches. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. What questions do you have about microplastics, where they come from, what their impact on the environment and on our food chain might be? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. And Gabby and Jen, let's go to our listeners. And Peter's joining us from Lyme. Hi, Peter. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah. So we have a laboratory in Lyme, New Hampshire for high school students to do research. It's a pretty advanced lab that does toxicological research. And we were wondering, as we enter this subject of studying microplastics, can you give some advice on how to identify the different plastics that are in a given sample?
Peter, thanks for calling in. And Gabby, you want to take that one?
Sure. So for our project that we do, we don't have a lot of money to do a lot of high-tech type of stuff. It's for us, it's a really easy way of just using tweezers and sometimes a microscope and doing simple things like or a hot needle. If you actually touch those pieces that you think might be plastic, they'll melt. Or you can also float them. So different densities of plastics will float. That's one way we get rid of it. And then you can also, one way that we get to the size fractions that we want is through sifting them. The other way you could do it, if you do have access to lab equipment, is through gas mass spectroscopy, and also there's other spectrophotometer type of equipment that you can use, and you can get even more high tech for the smaller pieces.
Well, and Peter, we put a video of Gabby and some of her volunteers on the beach doing some of those sifting techniques. So check it out on our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Go ahead, Jen. You wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I was just going to add basically that at our sampling, we're basically sampling a meter square section of beach and sifting out the 5 millimeter and the 1 to 5 millimeter sizes, and then we take them back and just do a count. So trying to low budget way to figure out, you know, are we looking at those styrofoam balls or fragments of, you know, plastics like fragments of bottle caps or films like those drink box straw wrappers, and just see where the, you know, most is. And then basically we can use that to hopefully influence policy or do education. And styrofoam is the biggest thing, I would say, that we find. And so basically, yeah, we just take that sample and just kind of count it up. So there's lots of ways you can go even further and, you know, analyze the exact type of plastic in a lab. But
so, and we'll definitely talk in a few minutes about policy, what small changes might help at the individual or policy level. Would help with this. I went, for example, to a coastal restaurant recently in Maine, and they said, nope, no plastic straws for you. We just don't do that. It's too problematic for the ecosystem. But before we get there, Jen, why doesn't plastic biodegrade like a paper bag would?
So plastic is basically, it's petroleum-based. So there's an issue, too, with making a lot of plastic is we're using more petroleum and fossil fuels. But it just basically doesn't break down into natural elements. It doesn't really biodegrade in the strict definition of biodegrade. And you know, maybe Gabby can talk about that more. But there is supposedly biodegradable plastic, which
yeah, I've heard about that. Is that legit?
You know, it seems to be the magic solution and compostable plastic. So there are a lot of issues with it. It's, you know, in some cases it might be better than your traditional plastic, but in a lot of cases it's not. There's biodegradable straws, you know, that are made out of a corn-based plastic, supposedly, that I read about not too long ago. And a lot of times it's just a percentage of that plastic that's, you know, plant-based. The rest is more petroleum-based. And then it really creates a problem because you can't recycle them, really. And a lot of times they might be, technically compostable, but they're only compostable in an industrial composting facility. So they need to go to a place.
Don't throw it in your backyard, you know, compost pile.
Right, exactly. You can't just throw it in your backyard. And
that's a little bit tricky,
right,
isn't it?
And a lot of times if you take those, if you bring it home, and you can't throw it in your compost pile, and you can't throw it in your recycling pile, and you throw it in the landfill, then they're producing more greenhouse gases when they compose than regular plastic. So that's causing another disposable problem. So there's not really a great way to handle those.
So very basic question, talking about why don't plastics break down? I'd love to hear from you, Gabby. Both of you said at the beginning of the show that some of these microplastics were micro from the beginning. They're present in like personal care products and so forth. But some of them are the breakdown of these larger pieces of garbage that we see in the ocean. So if they break down into microplastics, how come they don't break down into just like disappearing?
Well, for all intents and purposes, they do. They actually will break down to the point where you can't detect it other than its chemical components.
And so, that's the problem.
And that is the problem. And the chemical components are, you know, things like bisphenol A and polyphenols and things like that that just don't break down. They just and to sort of backtrack a little bit, take a soda bottle, for example, a plastic soda bottle, and it's out floating, and a lot of the plastic properties get degraded through sun and wind and things like that, which makes them very brittle. So I don't know if you've ever been to the beach and seen a plastic bottle and you pick it up and it disintegrates in your hands. And those pieces are tiny. You can't get them all. And then they go out into the ocean and so on. So they just get very, very brittle. And eventually, part of the problem is that what you see with the Pacific garbage patches and the other gyres is that you see the surface, but you don't realize that it goes all the way down through the water column.
Kind of like a soup, I've heard.
Yes,
huh?
It's a soup. It's not the giant pieces of floating bottles and containers. It's tiny little pieces, and it actually permeates through the depths of the ocean. I mean, then eventually they will settle out into the sediments. So, so that's the primary issue, is that it will break down into the different components, the different polymers.
And the polymers are chemicals. They're dangerous. They're bad for animal health. And if you happen to eat those animals in the form of fish or shellfish or whatever, you don't know what you're getting.
Right, exactly. And you don't know what the concentrations of those are. So that's really the sort of insidious part of this, right, is that it's everywhere. It's in the food chain. And you just don't know what component is actually contributing to either health effects or damaging the ecosystem and so on.
Okay, lots more to talk about in just a moment, and we'll keep taking your calls. Thank you, Peter, for that one. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email with your questions and observations about microplastics. Our email address, exchange@nhpr.org.
Spring is just about here, and Morning Edition is hitting the road. In our new weekly series, we're traveling across the Granite State to take you to new places and introduce you to new people.
Yeah, the moon looks very cinematic. What are we expecting to see tonight?
Now, people come here to see the alpacas.
Homebrewers starting out, how do you get from just whipping up batches in your basement to opening up your own tasting room?
Listen to Radio Field Trips, Morning Edition's new series about New Hampshire life and culture, Wednesday mornings from 5 to 9, on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, microplastics, tiny pieces that never break down. Instead, as we're hearing, they show up in our oceans, on our beaches here in New Hampshire. What questions do you have about microplastics? What observations have you made? Send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Send us your questions now so we can get them in. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Also, a reminder that in 20 minutes, it's our Race for the First series. Our first congressional district candidate today will be Democrat Daeglin McEachran. So you can get your questions in for Mr. McEachran as well. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. Right now, two researchers are keeping us up to date on microplastics. They are Jennifer Kennedy at the Blue Ocean Society, survey director at the Marine Debris Monitoring Program at Jenness Beach. Gabby Bratt is also here, fisheries specialist with UNH Cooperative Extension and the New Hampshire Sea Grant. And both of you, let's go back to our listeners. Chris is calling from Barrington. Hi, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
So I thought that this is a great topic that you are covering. Thank you for making it a very local piece to talk about. And I wanted to share. I just watched over the weekend this great motion graphic about something that's happening off the coast of California that's been happening for years, called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, which I'm sure that your two guests have a lot of knowledge on. And it's basically a garbage patch that's now estimated to be the size of actually the country of France times three. So three Frances worth of size of floating garbage off of California. And I wanted to know if your guests could kind of speak to that on a larger global sense, just to give that kind of bigger picture as well as working on what's happening locally.
Yeah, it's pretty sobering, Chris, and I appreciate the call. And I was reading just this morning, Jen, that lots of questions about how big these things actually are. Some people say the size of Texas, three Frances, whatever. But I was interested to learn that there's not just one. There's a couple of these big old things in the Pacific especially.
Right. There's a gyre in each ocean. So,
and what's a gyre?
A gyre is, a lot of people use the terms garbage patch and gyre interchangeably, but gyre is really an oceanographic term. So it's more like the currents circle around, I think of it almost like a big whirlpool in the ocean where everything just kind of comes together as the currents are circling, as the water's moving around in the ocean. And so, it's not necessarily, so trash is there, gathers there just because that's where the water kind of swirls around. But if you think about it, there's, almost like little gyres or these little eddies or currents in lots of different places. So if you walk down to Portsmouth, to the Piscataquis River for example, and go down to Prescott Park and look near the dock there, you'll look down and you'll probably see water swirling around somewhere, and there'll probably be, seaweed and trash and stuff kind of gathered up in that area. So, there's these big ones that are pretty widespread just because it's an ocean-wide gyre where, all the, water basically in the Pacific kind of swirls around this one big area. The problem is, a lot of times in the news, it's portrayed as this floating island of trash. And unfortunately, that's not the case. If it was a floating island of trash, it'd be pretty easy to relatively easy to go out there and just clean it up.
Well, I'm glad you said that because, reading this, I think, okay, can we just get a big giant boat and go pick it up?
Right. The problem is I've seen, great images of people that actually sailed through the garbage patch. And in the images I've seen, you can't even see the trash. If they're looking over the boat, it just looks like blue ocean. But if you look down or if you took a sample, they oftentimes will use a plankton net to sample the plastics and the plankton that are there, it more looks like a plastic soup. So the samples I've seen, sometimes they'll put samples in a jar of the seawater from the garbage patch, and it just looks like, confetti of plastic.
Yikes.
Inside.
Wow.
Which makes it really difficult to clean up, because if you go out there and try to scoop it all up, you're going to end up scooping up a lot of marine life as well. And so that's going to create some damage to the ecosystem. So, cleaning it up would be great, but a lot of focus, in recent years has been, even if you went out there and you cleaned it all up today, it'd be back out there tomorrow, because we're still using single-use disposable plastics. We're not always managing our trash very well in some areas, and the trash is going to get out there anyway until we start preventing some of this plastic from being used and getting out in the ocean in the first place.
Go ahead, Gabby. I know you want to jump in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, to give it a more of a global perspective, it's not just in the gyres either. It is a global problem. You can find it up on the North Pole. It's in the in the sea ice. It is in the benthic ecosystem, you know, in Antarctica. And there are
What's
global...
the benthic ecosystem?
So the ground, the ocean bottom.
I see.
So, you know, even deep, deep in the ocean. So it is all the way through the entire depth of the ocean in this sort of plastic soup component or idea. And there have been some global estimates. And just to give you an example, it ranges from 14,400 tons to 268,940 tons.
I can't even really wrap my head around that.
Right. And that's the issue. Most people can't. And like Jen said, you're sailing through, you know, the Pacific Ocean and it's blue and beautiful. And then you scoop it all up and it's right there. You can do, they call them manta trawls. And it's just a big plankton net with a wide, wide mouth. And they tow it behind the boat. And every time they pull it back up, there are plastic samples in there, more and more plastic debris. So you can't really trawl and, you know, sort of vacuum it all up.
It's so cleaning up is a little more complicated than just scooping it off the surface.
Right.
But efforts must be underway, right? I mean, you can't just let that sit there. The ocean ultimately becomes a toxic soup, right, with all the chemicals leaching from these plastics and so
forth. I think that's where we are. You know, our oceans are in this sort of really precarious situation because there have been some efforts, some engineering efforts to try and clean it up. But the scale of what you would need, you also, you know, to come up with big booms that would trap it and suck it up and so on and so forth, they're incredibly expensive. And people aren't really taking into consideration what that would do to marine life as well, because you could also be
disruptive,
right? You could also be sucking up marine life in those booms and so on and so forth. So, and even if you have, they're called arrays. Even if you have these arrays, you would need many, many, many of them to do this work around the clock, essentially. So, I mean, I think what Jen and I are trying to get the point across is, you know, it's prevention at this point rather than let's clean it all up. Do your best. Eventually, I think it will sink, and the sediments are going to be the ultimate sink. And if eventually we can get down there, sure.
And the sediments you mentioned earlier, that's part of the issue too, right, Gabby? That you've got the plastics floating around, but then the chemicals leach from the plastics. We're not sure what fish are ingesting. Certainly shellfish, you know, clams, mussels, oysters, they're filter feeders. Is that the right way to say it? So they may be getting more of these. I mean, what do we know about
the
impact on food?
Right. So unfortunately, we don't know that much. We do know that almost every organism from the size of a tiny little, ocean flea, for lack of a better term, to big whales have ingested microplastics or plastics of some sort. You can see them in the microscopes and everything. The problem is the toxicity levels of things. We don't know. We don't know which chemicals are contributing to what component of toxicity and what the concentrations are. So at what point is something considered toxic to humans? We don't even have that information yet. We just know that it can be ingested and transferred from plankton to fish to whales to humans.
Sure.
The one thing I will, especially for fish, so in case we got a lot of seafood lovers out there, which
we do. I had fish tacos last night, so I'm sitting here listening to you going, okay.
Which we do, is that, you know, we eat a lot. We eat clean seafood. So you're not eating, if you're thinking about how you ingest it, a fish, it goes through their mouth, into their digestive tract, into their stomach. How often are you eating fish stomachs? You're not. So in that sense, that should give a little comfort that you're probably not ingesting giant amounts through at least fish. At the smaller sizes, the question is whether or not it's sort of transferring through the stomachs into the muscle tissue, and that's still unknown. And again, the concentrations, what is toxic? The main focus right now for people who are doing this work is to see what the effects of to shellfish, because they are filter feeders, and everything that they filter in the water will either end up in them or it gets shunted out into something called pseudofeces. So oysters in particular have a really good mechanism of figuring out what's nutritive for them and what isn't. And so one of the things that I'm interested in looking at, if I can ever find money, is to see what percentages, you know, at what concentrations do the oysters stop shunting things that are called pseudofeces that will not go through their digestive tract, and at one point does it become embedded into their muscle tissue?
Go ahead, Jen.
I was just going to latch on as far as the cleanup and prevention goes. And I think if you are concerned about these Great Pacific Garbage Patches, if you want to call them that, and the trash out in the ocean, really, you know, prevention is the solution. Trying not to use so much plastic, being aware of what you're buying, you know, using a reusable water bottle or travel mug instead of, you know, going out and getting your coffee in a styrofoam cup or whatever. And, you know, one of the reasons why we do beach cleanups, we hopefully will put ourselves out of the cleanup business eventually someday and not have to go to the beach and clean things up. But at least right now it is kind of a last ditch effort to get that stuff off the beach before it goes out of the ocean, ends up in these, you know, gyre areas, breaks up into smaller and smaller pieces.
So at least you're doing something, recognizing that there's a lot more.
Right. And everybody can do that. You don't need to join a organized cleanup. You can go to the beach and we know a lot of people that just walk the beach every morning and bring a bag with them, which is awesome.
Let's take another call. This is Henry in Troy. Hi, Henry. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Laura. Great show.
Good.
I just wanted to ask a question of your panelists, which is, 35 years ago or 40 years ago, most containers we purchased at grocery stores were glass. It was recyclable. There was a deposit. You return it to the store, which promotes recycling. I understand the shipping weight is heavier, maybe the energy impact is a little bit larger than producing plastic, but in the end, it is recyclable. How hard would it be for the industry to go back and perhaps start penalizing plastic producers?
This gets us into the policy area, and I want to let you know, Henry, that we're doing a whole show on recycling and some of the issues concerning single-stream recycling, the crash in some of the recycling markets and so forth on Thursday, I believe. So stay tuned for that. But go ahead, Gabby. What do you think?
I think it would be incredibly difficult for the industry to stop because it is so cheap to make these single-use plastics. And again, a lot of it is the bottom line. If it's more expensive for restaurants or other industries to carry paper straws or plastic or glass bottles or even just redoing dishes, I think it has to meet their bottom line is sort of the word on the street that I've come across. I don't think, you know, technically it would be that difficult to go back to it. It's just how it will affect the economics of things.
Go ahead, Jen.
And I totally agree with that. And just, you know, there has to be demand for it. So people have to be asking for things in glass containers or, you know, going to the store and, you know, purchasing the juice that's in the glass bottle over the plastic bottle. And I think that's, you know, one of the best ways if there was, you know, public will for that to kind of turn around. I've heard of, I can't remember what country it is in Europe, but there's a plastic-free aisle in the grocery store. Good luck finding that in the United States. So I think if people were actually, you know, demanding it and, you know, using your money to vote, basically, when you shop.
Well, in some places in the United States and definitely in Europe, you have to pay if you want a plastic bag. Which is an incentive to bring your own bag. And I remember going to one particular store in France a couple years ago, and, you know, I was traveling, so I didn't have a bag because I don't live there, obviously. And I bought a couple things, and I said, can I have a bag for that? And they said, no, we don't have any. You'll have to carry it. So, okay, there you go. Gabby, did you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, sort of agree with Jen, that it really is now the impetus on the consumer to demand, you know, what we call stupid plastics. Like, at least with the grocery store, you know, things that already have natural packaging, like bananas and apples and, and things that already have their own packaging, don't need extra plastic or styrofoam to be, you know, to be protected. And so, you know, stop buying those things. Buy the actual cucumber without the plastic wrap. I never bring plastic bags for anything. And I actually could get all my produce and it's loose and it drives the checkers crazy. But they're like, do you want a plastic? No, they're loose on purpose.
I'm picturing you with your cucumbers and apples like tumbling down.
Tumbling over. They're like, ah.
So wait, if you buy five apples, you don't put them in the little plastic bag?
I either bring my own produce bag that I have bought, or I just say put it all in the same bag. And, you know, if I get a bruised apple, I cut that part out. So
it's worth it.
It is worth it.
All right, let's take another call. And thank you for that one. Stacy is calling in from Concord. Hi, Stacy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
I've been watching the show for years.
Good.
Prior to the early 80s, every hospital in the country had stainless steel everything from wash basins, bedpans to surgical instruments, and they would autoclave them to clean them. And back in the early 80s, every hospital in the country went to disposable plastics.
And so what do you think the solution is, Stacy, that we should go back? Or
to go back, yeah. To go back, for sure. I mean, I'm sure they've got all that stuff somewhere. I hope they didn't just put it in the landfill, because that would have just added to the problem.
Well, Stacy, thank you for the call. This is this societal change that we keep talking about, Jen, and it's pretty recent, Stacy's reminding us. Not that long ago, people just used, you know, metal or glass.
It's true. I think, you know, hospitals are a different story, but I think one of the positive things is that there are a lot of schools that are now going in the opposite direction. You know, they were using styrofoam trays, now they're using reusable trays, or...
They're plastic, but they wash them.
Right. We have some schools lately, we have a Skip the Straw project, and we have some schools, there's one in Hampton, actually, that is now doing a straw-free Wednesday to try it out. I heard Rye Elementary did or is doing a month free of plastic straws just to kind of see how it goes. So I think, you know, again, and that's hospitals, like I said, might be difficult unless you actually work there. But, you know, a lot of people know people that are in schools and, you know, pressing, you know, if your kids are in school, you know, maybe that's something the kids could bring up. A lot of times it's been, you know, student initiated. Hey, plastic straws can hurt, you know, sea life or whatever. Is that something we can get out of the cafeteria? So
straw free Wednesday. You learn something new every day. Last thoughts from you, Gabby, on other large or small policy measures that would help with this, you know, pretty frightening problem of microplastics.
Yeah, well, I think policy is really difficult. You know, we have to, I guess, go back to the sort of proof of concept type thing. But I think my push would be to start the kids young. You know, tell them, no, you can't, you don't need a straw with every drink that you have. Take your own cups. Give them the resources to, you know, give them their own water bottle, stainless steel water bottle, and explain why. My kids go to the beach and ask me, can we just go to the beach like normal people and not have a trash bag? And I said, no, because we're not normal people anymore. And just initiatives like this. And it's almost like re-educating everybody when we were first starting to use seatbelts, right? It was really hard to remember to put your seatbelt on. But now it's second nature, and you don't have to remind the kids. It just is. And we, and I think that's where it's going to start, and they're going to, and this generation and so on will start demanding that, no, pay attention. We don't have the luxury to be disposable society anymore.
Well, both of you, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here. Jen, it was good to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jennifer Kennedy, Executive Director at the Blue Ocean Society, Survey Director for the Marine Debris Monitoring Program at Jenice Beach. And Gabby, good to see you too. Thank you for helping us out.
Thank you for having us.
That's Gabriella Bratt, Fisheries Specialist with UNH Cooperative Extension and the New Hampshire Sea Grant. Now, coming up, we continue our Race for the First series. The first congressional district is wide open in this year's midterm elections. There are lots of candidates. So the Exchange is spending every Monday getting to know them a little bit. Up next is Democrat Daeglyn McEachran. You can listen to our interview. You can watch it on Facebook Live. Go to NHPR's Facebook page and you'll find it there. You can also send us your questions for Mr. McEachran. Give us a call now so we can bring you into the conversation. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.